didn't put on my glasses because basically I'm blind without them, and so I don't want to see the look on anybody's face. I'm Allison Jacobson, and I am alcoholic. And I have been continuously sober since the 18th of February of this year, and for that I am truly grateful. That wasn't always my sobriety date, and as you will hear my story tonight, I, for good, bad, or indifferent, had added to my story. And but I'm going to start at the beginning. I am originally from upstate New York and born into an alcoholic home, although that does not make me alcoholic. I was actually adopted, and my biological family has, you know, just alcoholism everywhere. And my adopted family has alcoholism everywhere too. And so I, you know, either way, I was going to be around it. And, but just because it runs in my genes and just because I grew up in it does not make me alcoholic. I have an obsession and an allergy. Once I put alcohol in my system, I cannot predict the amount I am going to ingest that night or in the days to follow. And when I honestly want to, I cannot quit entirely, which means I can stop anytime, any day, you know, you name it, I can stop. The problem that I have, and from being in Alcoholics Anonymous quite some time, from what I've witnessed, we have a really hard time staying stopped. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous helps us with. That's what it treats. Alcoholics Anonymous treats my alcoholism as a condition. And so anyway, I grew up in upstate New York, and my first drunk of any memory I have was when I was 13 years old, and I was out. I laugh now. I'm 53 years old, and back when I was 13, my girlfriend and I considered this a double date. And now I have a son who's about to be 11. And if he came home and told me, you know, he has a little quote-unquote girlfriend right now. And I just laugh to myself. I just think, what are you talking about, buddy? But it's very real to him. And when my friend and I were 13, it was very real to us. And we were meeting these boys. There was a canal by the railroad tracks, so that's a great place for a double date. And all of us were going to have this little cookout, and the deal was we were all going to get alcohol from our homes. And back then it was the very late 70s. I think it was 79. And you could make a fake ID, and nobody cared. It wasn't the fancy licenses that the Commonwealth has today with the holograms and the print, you know, the thumbprint, all that stuff. It was paper. And you could take the piece of paper out of the back and put your own information in. And that's what we did. And my friend Jennifer did it, actually. I did not do it. But I went to the pharmacy with her. I think it was a Rite Aid pharmacy in Rochester, New York. And she bought 2 6-packs of Molson Golden. And so we were going to have this little hamburger hot dog cookout. And there we were. And that night, you know, I'll tell you, I don't remember, like, my first a lot of things. I don't remember my first ice cream cone. I don't remember my first steak, although I don't even eat steak anymore. But I don't remember a lot of that stuff. I remember this night like it was yesterday, and it was 40 years ago. I had a flask of Burgundy, a flask of vodka, and 4 Molson Goldens. And leading up to that night, I heard a guy say once that he was just born not feeling good. And I related to that. I laughed, but I really related to that. I'm not going to say I walked around depressed or anything like that. I certainly did not. But I never felt like I measured up, you know. I was angry. My parents fought a lot. And it was just, we had a disruptive household. It was just, I always had some kind of angst. I always thought you all had more, or you were prettier, or you were smarter or funnier. And so I felt like I had to give 120% just to be like at a 90% level, you know? And this night changed everything. My favorite line in our basic text is, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Oh my gosh, that is me. The only word I would ever change from that is we love the effect produced by alcohol. I was always looking for an escape at an early age. Even today, I still am an avid movie fan. I love it like when Netflix came around and Hulu and all that, I'm like in heaven because I have like on demand any kind of movie I ever want to watch and I can kind of escape into that. And I didn't know it when I was 13 that I didn't like how I felt. It was just like I always just felt a little inadequate. And so this night, I liked this boy named Sean Connon. And anyway, I had all that alcohol in a very short amount of time. You know, it doesn't hit you right away. And then when it hits, it really hits. And it hit that night. But for about 40 minutes, maybe 40 minutes to an hour, I felt a freedom that I was never going to again experience until I started doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just amazing. I told you I felt better. You know, I used to feel worse than people. I felt better than them. I felt beautiful. I felt funny. I just felt like... if any of you have seen that Titanic movie, something I forget now, but like we can rule the world or we're at the top of the world or something like that. That's how alcohol made me feel. It was just amazing. And that night turned out to be an unbelievable disaster. I got really, really sick. I'm surprised I didn't just roll myself into the canal because I was rolling in the dirt and crying and just, you know, the stuff that we do that makes people want to hang around us more and more. And it was awful. And fortunately or unfortunately for me, there was like a townhouse and condominium complex near this railroad track canal set up. I lived there. And somebody heard this whole goings on and they called 911. And back in 1979, you weren't going to be arrested or anything like that. But I was taken home in an ambulance and we lived on a cul-de-sac. And my aunt was visiting us that weekend, and she and my mom had to stay up with me all night while I got ill. And, you know, one of those you're grounded forever kind of moments. And the next morning I came to. I'm not going to say I woke up. I came to, and that was going to be the story of my life for a very long time. And I came to, and the thought, well, at first I blacked out, you know. First night I get drunk, total blackout. I don't remember rolling around. This was all told to me. I remember that amazing feeling I got from alcohol, but I don't remember all the hideous stuff that happened. My girlfriend called me the next day and told me that. And I remember I came to, and it was like, oh, no. What went on? And I noticed I had bruises all over me, probably from rolling around. My body hurt. It was just, I did not feel well. And I knew I was going to be in a lot of trouble. And you know what went through my mind? Not, oh my God, I'm never going to do that again. I need to apologize to my friends. I have a girlfriend who is a normal social drinker. And one night she was out with some friends after work and she had more than two and her eyes started getting blurry. And she will never, ever have more than two because she doesn't like that out of control feeling. That thought did not go through my mind. It was like, you know, if I can somehow manage, maybe I need to eat before I go out so I don't get sick. Or maybe, you know, I've got to figure this out so the alcohol doesn't affect me as quickly and I don't make such a jerk out of myself. I was already in my mind trying to figure out how am I going to control and enjoy my drinking. It wasn't an option of, hey, you better not do that. It doesn't seem to agree with you. It's like, okay, I got to figure out how I can do this, get that feeling that I fell in love with on that night, but not have the consequences because nobody wants the consequences. And back then, I didn't drink in the morning yet. I didn't drink every day yet. It was going to be happening pretty quickly in short order, but I drank whenever I could. And whenever I drank, consequences followed, you know. And a big consequence that happened was, I'm not going to say this is a direct result of my alcoholism. Before I ever put a drink in my body, my mother and I just didn't like each other. We never got along. I hated her. She didn't like me. And before I even took a drink, I lied. I stole from you. I cheated. I would walk all over you to get what I want. I don't need alcohol to do that. I can do that stone cold sober. I started burning bridges well before I took a drink. Actually, when alcohol was introduced to my life, it was like a big exhale. It was like, oh, not that I ever thought of killing myself or anything like that, but it was like I have found my solution to living. I have a real problem. Our book calls it, we have a separation problem. I have a spiritual malady. And what that means to me and how it's been explained to me is I am disconnected from any kind of God of my understanding. I did not have one at that early age, I can assure you that. And I'm disconnected from my fellow man. I don't know it, but I am. And that's all those feelings of uneasiness and feeling like I don't fit in, never feeling like I had a purpose. All that craziness was my spiritual malady. And so when alcohol was introduced to my life, it was like, well, here's one solution for it. And I used to tell people, and I still will, given the opportunity, I am going to treat my alcoholism either with alcohol or with the spiritual principles of this program. And that's usually how I see it treated. So that night I didn't start drinking every day. I didn't start drinking in the morning, all that stuff. And I told you I didn't get along with my mom. And my brother had been shipped to Virginia the year before because of things he was doing. Our parents had divorced by then, and our dad lived in Virginia. And all of a sudden, my dad had gotten sober, and he was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Who knew, you know? And so my mom sent my older brother, Stephen, to live with my dad, and it was just me and my mom. And we just didn't speak to each other. And she would go to bed every night and lock herself and her purse in her room. And that's how we were living. And we were going to this family therapy thing, and I just hated it. Oh, my God, I hated it. But I'm a very good manipulator. When I want something, boy, I can say whatever I need to say if it's going to get me what I need. And so we're in this family therapy session, and my mom wanted to go visit her sister in Ithaca. And I didn't want to go, you know. And at that point, I was probably 14 or so, about to begin high school, and didn't really like anybody, and at least family-related anyway. And I somehow managed to manipulate in this family therapy session that the counselor made my mom feel so bad about not trusting me, she was going to leave me for the weekend alone. And you know what that means. And I had that party planned before she even got in her car to drive to Ithaca. And what I did not know, although I should have known, my mom asked a neighbor, my best friend's mom, to watch our house. And this is way before cell phones or any of that other baloney. And thank God. I saw something on Facebook. It said, I'm glad I did what I did before the days of social media. And actually, up until recently, I was really glad about that, too. And so I had this whole thing planned. And all these people, half the people that were in my mom's home this evening, this particular evening, I didn't even know half of them. I mean, I knew my friends, but they invited their friends, and they invited their friends, and there was stuff going on in my mom's home that definitely should not have been going on, not just alcohol, but you can figure it out. It was 1979, you know? And so my friend's mom called my mom in Ithaca, and it's a two-hour drive, but my mom was on her way, and she walked into her house. It was full of, like, marijuana smoke, alcohol. There was people up in her room. It was just a disaster, and she got everybody cleared out of there pretty quick, and, of course, I was mad at her, and, you know, I hate you, blah, blah, blah. And it was really strange. My mom was different that night than she'd ever been. And she was totally calm, because normally my mom just would go off. And she was totally calm. She said, pack your stuff. You're moving to your father's now, too. And I didn't believe her. She had threatened me with that so many times. I thought, she's not going to make me move, and she can't make me move. That I had a big attitude problem. I was very anti-authority, you can't tell me what to do, screw you, all the other rest of it. And that's how I acted. I'm not proud of that at all, but that's where I was at the time. And so the next morning rolls around, and I probably, you know, passed out in the clothes I was wearing the night before. And my mom's like, all right, are you ready? And I was like, are you kidding me? And that's how I landed in Virginia. A very auspicious start, you know. And my dad picked me up at the airport, and by then I was smoking cigarettes, and of course, you know, I was drinking and just doing a whole bunch of stuff. And in this year, prior to really drinking a lot, I used to be interested in things. I used to be a good student. I used to have a lot of nice friends. I used to be really involved with sports. As short as I am, I was on a basketball team. And in my middle school, I was on a volleyball team. I was captain of the cheerleaders. I just did all this stuff. And at the time I got shipped to Virginia, I was doing none of it. And as a matter of fact, my best friend from Girl Scouts, her mother told her she could not hang around me anymore. And that just about broke me. And I just thought, but you don't understand. I'm a nice person, you know? Even throughout my drinking, I always wanted to be a nice person. I never wanted to do the things I did, yet I did them anyway because I didn't know how to tap into that power greater than myself. You know, I was relying on me and my resources, and that's what I got. So I got shipped to Virginia, and my dad picked me up at Dulles Airport, and I spent my high school years growing up in Reston and all over Northern Virginia after that. I've lived just about everywhere you can live in Northern Virginia. And my dad and I were driving back to our home, and he's like, I know you smoke cigarettes. I know you drink alcohol. And, you know, what happened to my daughter? It was one of those speeches. And he was just wanted so badly to be the person that helped me turn around, you know, and being a parent now, I can understand that, you know, it's just got to be an awful feeling watching your child sink into the mire of, ugh. Yet I kept sinking. my poor father, I gave that man so many sleepless nights sneaking out of the house. I mean, it was just how I graduated from high school. I cannot tell you. I really can't. I don't recall really ever studying. And I got into one college. That ought to tell you something. I applied to several, but I got into one. And that's where my drinking absolutely took off. It was already taking off in high school. I had a horrible reputation as just being a drunk. One of the guys I dated, he's like, well, you know, my girlfriend's alcoholic. I think we're 16 years old at the time. And I think, oh, my gosh. And so anyway, I went away to college. And water seeks its own level. And alcoholics have a really funny way of hooking up with each other. You know, there's, what, 5,000 people on a campus, and you're going to find the one person who drinks like you. And I did. She lived we weren't dorm mates, but she lived in my dorm. We weren't roommates. And eventually we became roommates until I even alienated her. I started alienating people who drank like I did. That's not good. And I lasted at college for 1 year, and I started having seizures. It was just awful. It was awful. My withdrawal when I was younger was absolutely horrible. It was just vomiting, shaking, sweating, seizures, and everything but DTs. And I needed a drink. And by then, my friend Courtney introduced me to the morning drink, and I didn't just drink to get rid of a hangover. That was how I started my day. It's like, you know, normally you get up and you have a cup of coffee, you might pray and meditate. I popped open a beer, and that's what I drank back then. And I just thought it was fantastic. No parents, no real rules. But I also found out that if you don't go to class, they don't look very kindly on that. And so I was put on academic probation and just all this. Blah. And after my first year, I thought, you know what? I don't even know what I'm going to school for anyway. But you know, that's my national anthem. When anything got too hard or anything interfered with my drinking, it wasn't like I thought about, okay, maybe I'm drinking too much. Maybe I need to stop. This is a real problem. I cannot sustain relationships, and not just like boyfriend relationships. I couldn't even sustain friendships. You know, I was changing my friends all the time. And it was all because of my alcoholism. I couldn't tell you the truth. I couldn't be a friend among friends. I couldn't be a worker among workers. I needed to drink, and that's what I did. And if you threatened to get in the way of what I needed to do, it was easier to cut you out or whatever the event is than to look at myself. I had a real hard time looking at myself. And I gotta try to keep track of time. All right. So I dropped out of college. And I know it crushed my parents. My parents are big into college and education. And my dad, both of them, it crushed them. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I wanted to work so I could earn money and drink. And like the next 3 years or so of my life, I lived with my dad. And I worked and I drank. And I'll tell you how I worked. If I got up in time to go to work, I would go. I told you I'm a morning drinker by now. So I would come to about 4:30, have like two or three beers, and actually think I could go to work in that condition. Put makeup on over yesterday's makeup, not shower for several weeks at a time. And I thought I looked good. I really did. And I was wondering why I couldn't hold a job. You know, I went through so many jobs. I don't even remember at this point. I'm too old to remember all that. I just know I went through tons. And when people were on to my alcoholism, I just wouldn't go back. I didn't think about calling, nothing. It's just like I didn't want to deal with that stuff. I couldn't deal with the consequences of my behavior. I didn't want to have to look at myself, and I didn't want you to interfere with my alcoholism. And so as a result of really not being able to hold a job for any length of time, I didn't have a lot of money. And when my dad finally told me I had to move out, he was tired of paying for me, I had a hard time keeping a place. And I used to laugh and say this, but it's really not that funny. I know somebody who's like this now. The only time everything was turned on in one of my apartments was like the first month I lived there. You know, the TV, the electric, the rent was paid. And then after that, it was really just a poker shoot as to what was going to be on and what wasn't, because I needed to drink. I needed to drink more than I needed electricity, more than I needed food, more than I needed to pay a car payment, you know, except I usually did keep up with the car payment because I thought if I end up truly homeless, at least I have my car. Now that is sad and pathetic, that was actually a rational thought that went through my mind. But back in my 20s, it actually did. I thought, well, I got my car. And to think that that was actually a real option for me, that kind of frightens me today. I know somebody who's going through that right now. And if I stop talking about me for a while, I'll talk about that situation too. So anyway, I think in the late 80s, I want to say, I started my round of treatment centers. And I'm not going to go into all of that, but I've been through four. I've probably been through three, four detoxes. I can't tell you how many psychiatrists and psychologists I've been through. And I just for laughs, I always, and this is true, I used to call the psychic hotline because I thought maybe they had a solution for my alcoholism. I would stay up late just drinking beer. And, you know, if you're up late enough, the commercials come on TV. And actually now, sometimes on the weekends, I'll just stay up late watching whatever's on TV. And now I see the treatment center commercials come on TV. But back then it was the psychic hotline. And I actually called them super, super drunk. But I called them. And back then I used to do a lot of that. I call it drunken dial. And I'd call family members and tell them off. A lot of times I wouldn't know who I called until I got the phone bill. So no wonder I was so alienated from my family. You know, I was alienated from everybody. I was so lonely, and wanting a connection, but the only connection I had was my alcohol. It was the only relief I knew. And I have drank alcohol with cockroaches in it. I've lived with places with cockroaches in it. I remember there were so many cockroaches in this place. I was at work one day that I actually showed up, and I had a shirt with a pocket on, and a cockroach came right out of the pocket. I thought, oh, my God. And I didn't care because it allowed me to drink. And so, as I told you, as long as I can have my alcohol, the rest of it, I'm sure at some level I did care, but when you're in the throes of your alcoholism, you just can't care about that stuff. So anyway, I started my round of treatment centers, and mostly to get my family off my back, you know, my godparents. I remember my godmother, who I dearly love, and I'm named after her, actually, and she called me one morning at 5 a.m, except what she didn't know is I'd already been drinking. And she's like, I'm calling you because I'm thinking this might be the only time of day you're still sober. And I still was coherent. I even remember the conversation today. But and she, you know, gave me a lecture about my drinking. I had so many well-meaning people just beg me to stop drinking. And I'm sure people here have heard this. You have so much potential. Why don't you go back to school? Why don't you do, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think in my mind, I wanted to do all that stuff, but I wasn't willing. I was like the book says, you get to a point you can't imagine your life with alcohol, but you definitely can't imagine it without it. I felt like the drowning man, you know, quicksand all around me. And the walls were beginning to come in on me. And I remember this one fortuitous evening, I was home watching TV and drinking because that's what my life had been reduced to. It wasn't like I was on a party scene or anything. I lived in a little apartment holed up in Arlington, Virginia, and I'd watch reruns of Nick at Night or whatever it was back then and just drink alcohol till I passed out. I'd wet the bed. I'd get up the next morning, pray to God I had enough quarters to do the laundry so I could clean the sheets. And if I didn't, that was okay. I was going to sleep in it anyway. And so one of these nights, I called my brother. And my brother was working in Maryland, in Cumberland, Maryland, at a wilderness program. I called him, and I told him I wanted to kill myself. And I was probably 25, 26 years old, and he's 2 years older than me. And he freaked out. He did. I didn't want to kill myself any more than I want to kill myself sitting here right now. I just needed attention. It was like I needed attention, lots of attention. I was never filled up. I was like a tick. And I'd suck you dry until I was too full, then I'd fall off and move on to the next person. Actually, I think a tick dies, but that's how I likened myself. I would attach myself to you. And so I called my brother, Stephen, and said I wanted to kill myself. And God is really funny. You know, even when I don't care enough about myself to take care of me, my old sponsor calls it God's grand ballet. She talks about how our program started with, you know, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And if you go back all the way to, I think it's Roland Hazard seeing Dr. Young. And she calls it God's grand ballet. Well, God has a grand ballet in each one of our lives if we're going to open our eyes to it. Well, I definitely wasn't opening my eyes to God's grand ballet back then. But hindsight's 20/20, and when I look back, it's like, oh my gosh, this is all part of God's grand ballet. So I call my brother, and he's working at this wilderness program, and he says, well, you know what, Allison? My boss is in AA, and he's been sober about 3 years, and he's going to this Joe and Charlie seminar this weekend. Would you go if he can get you in? I thought I would die. I thought, oh my God, I called the wrong family member and told him I was going to kill myself because now I'm being offered a solution. And so one of my character defects is I have to the outside world, I can be dying on the inside and I will tell you everything is fine. And I care way too much about what you think of me. So, and this applied to my brother. I thought, well, I can't call him like this and then not go to this thing. I was like, oh my God. So I went. I wasn't going to go on Friday because I'm not going to an Alcoholics Anonymous anything for a whole weekend, but I'll go. And I had to fish out one of the four big books I own. I told you I've been through four treatment centers and I had one packed away in a cardboard box in my little apartment. And I drove to Frostburg, Maryland on a Saturday. And I walk into this thing, and that is how I met who is now my husband, Al. And it was back, Joe and Charlie back then were just on fire introducing the directions that are in our big book to all of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have some of their original tapes. It's amazing. I'm grateful that we have them, although we don't have any way to play them anymore. I don't think they're 8-track or they're the little cassette tapes, but we have them. It's our little collection. And I met my husband. And I didn't like him. He was just one of these exuberant, in love with Alcoholics Anonymous people. I'm a hungover woman, not looking to get sober, but get out of the consequences. But I actually listened that day. And I was embarrassed because Joe and Charlie are going through the directions on how to take our steps. It's the only suggested program of recovery we have, and I didn't know the directions for it were in this book. I've had 4 big books. I've been through how many treatment centers and detoxes? I had no idea. And so a seed was planted. I wasn't going to get sober then, but a seed was planted. And Al drove me nuts because back then he was really into acronyms. And he would say, you know what the STEP stands for? And I'd be like, no. And he'd say, solution to every problem, sober. And he just had a whole list of them. And he still tries to think of them today. I haven't heard one in a long time, but the most recent one I've heard from him, he was like, you know what the ism is in alcoholism, Allison? And I'm like, no. And he'll say, I sponsor myself, ha ha ha. And I'm just like, oh my God, this guy is a weirdo. But here's what I noticed about him, other than I thought that was a little too much. But he was the first person, and I've been through I can't tell you how many Alcoholics Anonymous meetings up to that point. They're all over Northern Virginia. My God, some of them I could walk to. And he was the first person I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, number one, who was genuinely enthusiastic about his sobriety. You know, in our literature, it tells us if we are not happy about our sobriety, we are not going to keep it. And somebody, after I got drunk, after being sober for quite some time, somebody reacquainted me with that line in the book. And I just thought, oh, my God. And he was the first person I met who was genuinely happy to be sober. And when I say that, I don't mean his life was problem-free. I don't mean he didn't have pressure. I don't mean his life was perfect. But he intuitively knew that his life was better without a drink, and that anything that came down the pike, a drink was not going to make it better. It was going to make it far worse. And that was new to me. There was something about that that really attracted me, though I didn't know it then. I just was like, who is this AA freak? And I really kind of thought that. But of course you're going to think that when you're not ready to get sober. You know, if you're just coming to Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody is making you come, you're going to meet somebody who really loves being sober, and you're going to be like, stay away from me. You know, I don't want to catch what you have. You're still protecting your alcoholism. And I was protecting my alcoholism. I was protecting my right to drink, my right to kill myself, really. And then, so that was 1992, if you can believe that. There are some people who are as old as me in this room, I know that. So that was back in 1992. And I was not going to get sober again until the 5th of June, 1993. That was my very first permanent sobriety date. And Al and I happened to meet up again. And we started dating, and I laugh because I don't think you date in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you are attracted to each other, and then it's like you move in together. Nobody talks about anything. Now, like, is this a good idea? Is this not a good idea? We're just like, whew! And that's how we were. We got married when I was 9 months sober. And we've been married for over 25 years. Now, some of those years have been very, very difficult. But most of those years have not been. And now we seem to be on an upswing again, which I'm very, very grateful about. And that's just a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's got nothing to do with me. And so anyway, Al and I were on our little AA life. And back then, his sponsor was a taper. And we had no money. We had nothing. And both of us had like thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of debt that we needed to pay off. That it was going to take a long time. And his sponsor, Bob, who's no longer among us, he told us that if we helped him and his wife tape these conventions and really work at the table and all that stuff, he would pay for us to go to these conventions. And we went to at least one, sometimes two a month for a lot of years, actually. And it was just amazing. I heard all these people. I heard Clancy. I heard Ray O'Keefe. I heard so many people who are no longer among us. Jim Williams. And I just heard these people go through the steps. I heard their stories. We got to know them. And it was just, I had no idea back then what I had popped, you know, plopped in the middle of. And it was just this amazing AA world. I had no idea when I was stuck in and out of treatment and in and out of detox. I had no idea that Alcoholics Anonymous was such a huge world. I just thought it was very limited to you, wherever you live, you go to meetings, you hear the same people share the same stuff week in, week out, and you don't drink. And that is not sobriety. I mean, that is part of it. I mean, we live in a very, very small community. On Monday night, in our little Dilwyn meeting, there might be five of us. So we hear each other week in, week out, and I love it. I love hearing these people. But I also supplement my recovery by going to conferences, by going to retreats, by doing a lot of other things. Seeing that God saw fit to allow me to get sober again, I am taking advantage of every darn thing that I can take advantage of. That's just the way I feel about it. And so I'm plodding along in sobriety. And, you know, the years, the days add up to months, the months add up to years, the years add up to more years. And I was probably in our county, I was one of the women who had been sober the longest. There's not a lot of women in Dilwyn, Virginia. And a lot of the women who are there are not in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's, a lot of them need to be, but they're not. And my ego, the ego is a funny thing. You know, I remember coming into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time feeling so broken and just shattered, owing all this money, thinking I'd just blown up my life, and not even really thinking it. I had blown up my life, and overwhelmed with the wreckage, you know? And then you start staying sober a while. You get a sponsor. You start working with your sponsor. Things start working out, you know? You start doing the steps. Maybe along the way you start sponsoring people. And this ego is very deceptive. My ego is very deceptive. I'm not saying yours is. And all of a sudden, I started really kind of thinking I was somebody. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're all just drunks. I remember, and I've listened to it several times, when I start feeling full of myself, because even after all the mayhem I have caused over the last 4 years, I still have the nerve to get full of myself. It's just amazing how that works. And I listen to this tape, and this man says, the highest, not even achievement, the highest level any of us is ever going to get here is sober. And if you're sober, that's a gift from God. And if you are not repaying your God back by trying to give it away, then I don't care who you are. And that, he didn't say those words, but that's what he meant. And I have to remind myself of that all the time. I just started getting so full of myself and just living in ways that are not conducive to staying sober. Living in ways that, you know, I wouldn't be happy to talk to my son about. And all the while sponsoring women and giving them what I consider to be good direction. And I am sicker than anybody sitting in the room, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, well, these women still want direction from me. blah, 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 blah. And I just so full of self. If you could have taken a real life picture of my head, it probably spanned from that window to that door, or maybe even bigger. It probably would have started busting out the walls. It was just, that's how highly I thought of myself. There's a part in Bill Wilson's story that I've always related to, even before, and where he says, I had arrived. And I thought, you know what? I'm married to this man. We have a nice marriage. We own our own business. We're making a lot of money. We've both been sober. At that point, it was, well, he was sober over 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was approaching 20 years, and I just thought I was something, you know, and that's the only way I know how to put it. And it's, I'm almost ashamed to say that, but if anybody sitting here tonight is thinking that, I'm going to tell you the rest of what happened. I got sicker and sicker, and if you read our book, in the 10th step, it says, if we rest on our laurels, you know, meaning our past achievements. I had a lot of past achievements I was still getting mileage out of. Alcohol is a subtle foe. And I was living in a way that I was absolutely not okay with. Just not. I thought, you know, I would go to bed at night and I couldn't sleep. And it was like, okay, I'm going to stop all this mess tomorrow. I'm not going to live this way. Have you ever thought that when you're in the, like, the throes of your alcoholism? I'm going to stop drinking tomorrow. Just let me get through tonight. And tomorrow is a new day and a fresh slate. I'm not doing this anymore. I was so not free. I was so in the bondage of self. And I was scared all the time. I cried every single day. Most nights I went to bed in the fetal position because I was such a fraud. I remember my very favorite sponsor, Linda R., who's at the big meeting in the sky now. I used to call her and, you know, if I'd done something wrong or whatever, you know, you call your sponsor, you talk about it. I'd say, Linda, I feel so guilty. And she'd be like, Allison, you feel guilty because you are guilty. She never patted me on the back and said, oh, don't worry about it. She's like, you feel guilty because you are guilty. And I could hear her voice. I mean, this is going to sound really wacky. I thought, oh my God, I wonder if she's watching me from up above and saying, Allison, what are you doing? And I mean, all this craziness, I started getting so paranoid. And I felt that way because I was not living according to the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, I told you in the very beginning of this, I suffer from a spiritual malady. If I don't treat my spiritual illness with spiritual principles, then I'm going to treat my alcoholism with a drink. And that's finally what happened. And, you know, you would think after 21 years of sobriety, I'll tell you one thing I hate. I hate when people say, why didn't you call anybody? You know, why didn't you call me instead of taking a drink? If I'm already thinking of taking a drink and I've purchased the alcohol, I'm not calling you. What I should have done is I should have told my sponsor the truth. And trust me, I acted out that scenario so many times in my mind and justified why I couldn't talk to her about all this. Oh, she wouldn't understand, or, oh God, she might tell people. Who cares? My life was on the line. And so what I want to say, no matter what you're doing, if anybody here has a secret tonight, tell somebody, even if it's not your sponsor. What I was going to tell you is I had lots of reasons for not telling Beth what was going on, lots of them. And a lot of people probably would have agreed with some of my reasons, but I had been in AA a long time, and I had a network of very trustworthy women around me. There was no excuse for me not talking to somebody, you know? I wanted to protect how I looked to you. And so in a meeting, it was I forget where, some guy said something, and I love it, and I thought, wow, I wish I'd heard that a while ago. I don't know if it would have mattered. He said, you know what, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can either save your face or you can save your ass, but you can't do both. And I find that to be true. And I chose to save my face. And in the end, I ended up losing it all. I lost my face. I lost the respect of my peers. I lost my butt. I lost it all. And there was a point in my drinking when it started. I kept trying to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept trying. I'd get sober for a while, and then it'd be like, oh, hell, I'm never going to get back what I had, and heck with it all, you know? And I was facing losing my son, losing my marriage, losing everything that I loved. Everything. And my bottom started a year ago, actually, a year ago this past August. I had my son when I was 15 years sober, and I was 42 years old, and anybody who knew me knew I really always wanted to be a mother, and I feel so blessed that God allowed me to be a mother. And for the first several years of our son's life, and even when I did start drinking, I still tried to hang on to that so badly and go to all the events and do all the things. Well, last year, our son started fifth grade. And the big deal where he goes to school in fifth grade is the kids get a locker. And he was so excited about this locker. And they could decorate it. And anybody who's met our son, he has a lot of both his dad and me. And it's good, but I don't know. In a few years, I'm thinking, oh, please. And he gets he's very excited about life, as he should be at this age, you know. And he was just all these things that he wanted to order for his locker, a whiteboard. He even ordered this little square shag piece of carpet. I mean, just all, he went way over the top. And it was really fun. And last May, I went on Amazon after he got out of school. It was like the first day he got out of fourth grade. It's like, okay, I'm in fifth grade now. Let's think about decorating the locker. And so we got on Amazon and we got all these things for Jake to decorate his locker. And all summer long, he is like a dog with a bone, as a lot of kids are. And all summer long, he would talk about, Mama, I cannot wait to decorate my locker with you. And it was back to school night that we did it, you know. And he'd go in. I had all his stuff for his locker in the guest room. He'd go in periodically and look at it. And you could tell he was so excited. And I got drunk the night before back to school night. And I knew my husband was going to have a heart attack, as he should have. And I went to a hotel, and the fact that I did not get a DUI on this evening, I can't explain the reason why. I just didn't. The Buckingham County Police were not out that evening. And I holed up in a hotel, and I got this slew of texts from my son. And finally, the last one, he sent me a picture of his locker. He decorated it himself. And he wrote, "You missed it." And I thought I would die. You would think that would keep me sober. And it did for about 6 months. And then what is now my sobriety date was over President's Day weekend. And there was nothing different about that weekend, except it was a long weekend. And I had a case of the poor me's, and I'll never have 21 years of sobriety back again. I'll be in my 80s by the time that happens, and just bull, you know? And I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do it. I can't. I'm ashamed to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. By then, I had lost, you know, I didn't sponsor anybody anymore, and it was just, it was all about me and everything I'd lost. It was nothing about, hey, why don't you really try to stay sober? Do what you used to talk about and stay sober one day at a time. And a funny thing started happening. When I got up on February 18th, I really didn't think. I really had in my mind, okay, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to leave Al and Jake. Jake does not deserve a drunk mother. My husband grew up with a drunk mother. I've heard all those horror stories. And I just thought, there's no getting out of this mess. At that point, I don't think I'm being dramatic by saying my husband hated me. I think he really did. And I don't blame him, not one bit. And I don't know if he so much hated me as he hated what was happening. He just hated what was happening. And I don't know why. I woke up that morning and I thought, all right, I'm leaving. I'm just going to pack up my crap. I'm going to go. I don't know where I was going to go. I told you I'm adopted and I have a relationship with my biological mom. And I thought I could go there. And that's all the way in Arkansas, by the way. And I had a moment of clarity. And if any of you went to the Blue Ridge Speakers Meeting, their day event this past year, this man, Kent C., said it way better than what I could say it. But this is what happened to me on February 18th. He said he calls a moment of clarity where God suspends all the lies just long enough for you to see the truth. And I saw the truth. And I didn't like the truth. I don't even like talking about the truth now, obviously. But I saw the truth. And I saw how absolutely selfish and self-centered I had become again. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, whether people hate me or not, whether people judge me or not. I remember my husband back when I was having such a difficult time staying sober. He would go to meetings, and the poor man was in tears. And it was in Charlottesville, and all of a sudden, all these people stopped talking to me. And I just, God, I got to this point, I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, I can't even go in there anymore. And on February 18th, I didn't care. I thought, you know what? I deserve to be here just as much as anybody else does. And so help me God, if I go to a meeting and nobody talks to me, I don't care. I need to stay sober. And that's the first time in probably 4 years where I actually cared about staying sober, and I didn't even know it. And I find if I want to stay sober, all the booze fighting kind of goes away. You know, when I was sober before, I went through my father dying, my sponsor dying. I went through a lot of stuff, marital ups and downs. Not once during any of those times did I think about taking a drink because I cared about my sobriety. When I start caring about how I look to you or to me or what I've got materially, and sobriety starts, you know, I'm edging it out, that's when I'm in danger of taking a drink. I'm very, very transparent with my sponsor today. She has the same experience as I do. She was sober for quite some time and was drunk for 4 years, and now she's got 13 of those years back. And we've known each other for a long time. I talk about being a tough pill to swallow. I knew her when she got sober, and now she's sponsoring me, and that's okay. I'm very happy with that. I love her. I love that I can talk to her about anything, and it's okay. I have to be able to be willing to be that transparent, because I'm not saying, how do I want to say this? I'm not willing to take a drink anymore over that kind of stuff. My experience that I'm going to share with you right now is I thought all that stuff mattered. You know, my marriage has to be perfect again before I can get sober. I have to have the trust of my son back before I can get sober. I had all this conditional sobriety. I wanted all this stuff to be in place again. And none of it was. And yet I got sober. None of it was. My son was barely speaking to me. Now, I will say this. Kids are quite resilient, and little boys love their mothers, you know, and my son loves me. But I will tell you, my husband was out of town last night, and I had this huge day planned for me and Jake because I knew Jake was going to be worried that his dad was out of town. And our son does these horse show competitions, and we were at a horse show yesterday, and our son won champion of his division. And I was like, thank you, God, that I am sober to witness this, because it hadn't happened before. And I had all this stuff planned. We had a little birthday party. We had a little county thing to go to last night. And in the middle of the day, after the horse show, we were eating lunch, and he said, can I spend the night at Noonie's tonight? And Noonie, as many of you know, her, Helen, and she lives in our county, and she used to watch Jake for the first 9 years of his life when I went back to work, and she's like a grandmother to him, and that about killed me. I said, well, Jake, we've got these plans tonight. Why do you want to go there? And he's like, well, I'm really afraid, with Daddy being gone, that you might drink again. And what do you say to that? So I called my husband, and I told him what was going on, because I've learned now, you know, it's not just me being Jake's mom. Both of us are Jake's parents. And I don't want to make a decision without his input, which that's very new for me because I think, you know, I'm the alpha and the omega when it comes to our son. And so I'm trying very hard to include him. My sponsor said, well, you know, he is his father, so why don't you include him in some of these decisions? I thought, I never thought of that. So I called him, and I said, what do you think? And he said, well, here's what I think. And I couldn't believe it, and here's where I knew. I knew for a while my husband and I had been turning a corner. We went on a very nice summer vacation as a family, and he and I are beginning to do things, just me and him, and that hadn't happened in a lot of years. And we're just having a really nice time. And he said, here's what I think. He said, I think Jake needs to work through this with you. And he got on the phone with Jake, and he said, listen, I don't think your mom's going to drink. She says she's not going to, and I believe her. I almost died, and I had to keep a straight face. And he said, if anything happens contrary to that, you call me, and I'll come home. And we had a great night. And I thought, oh, thank you, God, you know? And we did the rest of what we did, and we just had a great time. And I'm not going to lie and say when my son asked if he could spend the night at somebody's house, that didn't just kill me. It did. But what I have to remember, in our literature, it says, at some point, we put ourselves in a position. We placed ourselves in a position to be hurt or have other people retaliate. I did that. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is one day at a time, not that I can undo that, but I am recreating my life and the lives of those around me. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.